One summer back in the 1980s, my wife and I went cat sitting in Andorra. The cat belonged to a distant relative of my wife's, and we jumped at the chance of spending a summer in this beautiful, mountainous little principality perched on top of the Pyrenees, squeezed in between France and Spain. Even in this strange environment, with apartment blocks built on the edge of plunging precipices, it stood out. Its owner was a former Rhodesian Air Force pilot, descendant of one of Europe's oldest banking dynasties, and like everyone else, was living in this weird principality because of its status as a tax-free haven. His bunker had been specially built to house not just the cat and him, but his collection of vintage sports cars. Andorra's expat population had its fair share of eccentrics. One day, as we trekked over a high mountain pass, we came across an amazing sight. A perfectly normal English bungalow surrounded by a lawn and shrubbery, complete with garden gnomes and a pond. A jolly red-faced man waved at us as he pushed his lawnmower across his flat square of grass surrounded by the barren, rocky plateau. But the strangest person we would meet was a man called Ivan Manfredo. He was a benign, middle-aged German hippie with a neat grey ponytail flopping over his unvarying uniform of dungarees and singlet, usually in bright pastel colours. He lived with a young hairdresser from Hamburg called Elke. She had a spiky blonde punk hairstyle, and wearing only her leopard skin bikini, would climb out of the window of Ivan's top floor apartment and swing, monkey-like, over a 1,000-foot drop up onto the roof to sunbathe. She was such a terrifying driver that none of us would get into her Jeep in the evenings when we headed off to pogo to vintage punk in nightclubs in distant, barely accessible valleys. She would speed around bends on single-lane roads clinging to the side of the mountain, where the only thing between you and the sheer drop was the little cross commemorating the last driver who had gone over. We preferred to follow at a more stately pace in one of the cars from the bunker. Ivan was a dealer in precious stones. One night, he took us down to his walk-in safe in the basement. There were little plastic pots of gems everywhere, and as I sank my hands into cool pools of sapphires and turquoise, I asked how he got into the trade. "It was chance, really," he said. "I had the contacts in South America and the Far East. At one time, I was the only one allowed into Burma, so I started to bring out rubies. I'd seen too many bad Hollywood movies about post-war Nazi networks, so I did a quick calculation. But by my reckoning, Ivan was too young to have even been in the Hitler Youth." "What kind of contacts?" I asked. "Oh, old boys from my school. Most of them live in different places all over the world now, but we keep in touch." Despite the hippie mannerisms, he had that unsleeping watchfulness you often find in people who have been in the military or in prison. And alcohol exaggerated it. Late at night, as we sat in his apartment drinking Spanish red wine, he talked, and it seemed as if his back grew straighter, his head larger. One night, he suddenly told me how his friend had tried to kill him recently. His friend was an arms dealer based in Bangkok, where he lived in a dilapidated villa surrounded by an overgrown jungle-like garden. After some heavy drinking, they played a game with bayonets. They had to track each other through the undergrowth and try to stab their opponent. Ivan lost. His friend pounced on him from behind, and at frustration at not being able to sink his blade in Ivan's back, had battered him with the hilt of the bayonet. "He was always a killer," said Ivan. "When we were in school, he killed one of our classmates." "Why?" I asked. "I don't remember why. I suppose it was the kind of thing expected of us." Then he told me about the school. It had been a special school in Prussia for the children of high-ranking army officers. "Quatsch," said Elke. "Nonsense." She was busy painting her toenails bright pink. "War, war, yakety yak." Ivan ignored her, stood up and left the room, returning with a photograph which he laid before us. I got a shock when I saw it. The child with the shaven blonde head in the photo was recognisably him, all right, though instead of dungarees, he was wearing a little black uniform. In February 1945, the Red Army was approaching Königsberg. They sent us out to fight the Russian tanks. He sighed and sipped his red wine. After that, he said, it all gets a bit hazy.
Bei der Kaserne vor dem großen Tor steht ne Laterne und steht sie noch davor.
Ever since I first saw them on a visit to the Derrick Hill Gallery in Donegal, I felt a bit intimidated by the paintings of the Torrey Island artists. Those almost simplistic views of an island landscape express a singular sense of place, as though the artist's very being is an extension of the Donegal Island, and that the island is, for them, the only place on earth. They come from lives intimately associated with a single location, speaking eloquently of familiarity, of identity, all disconcertingly at odds with my own experience of these things. Recently, I was set a task that's become an almost inescapable part of modern life for anyone who wants to work or volunteer at a sports or youth club, filling in the Garda vetting form. I was immediately daunted when I saw the form has space for only 12 past addresses, and wants not only every address I've ever lived at since I was born, but also the dates. Given the purpose for which it is intended, to confirm that I have not committed a crime, but also to chart my own personal geography, I strive for utter accuracy, mining my own memories associated with the houses I've lived in and cross-checking them with dates of historical events. I start in November 1967. I am the third and last child of Dennis Soroka and Mary McAvoy, and we live in a white, timber-clad house on a tree-lined avenue in a well-off lakeside suburb of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, USA. Though they are integral to the process, there is no space on the form for memories. If there were, I would only have a few for this house. The smell of snow, the magic glow of Christmas tree lights, crawling into my parents' bed in the middle of the night, realizing my sister had an intellectual disability, or at least was somehow different. I was in this house for less than 3 years. My time there ended with my parents' divorce, an event I do not remember, but it's a fact, documented in a Milwaukee court building. Then, a house which I have no memory of, but one my mother tells me about. Though it does not exist in my own mind, it must exist on the form. Then comes the upper floor of a house in a poor part of Milwaukee, starting school with black, Hispanic and white children, going to anti-Vietnam demonstrations with my mother, learning the words of Don McLean's song, American Pie. My father collecting my brother, sister and me for visits, sitting at a window watching a thunderstorm. Abruptly, in September 1973, we moved to Ireland, the land of my mother's ancestors. The lines on the Garda vetting form continue to fill up. In 2.5 years, I live in rented houses or flats across South Dublin, Belmont Avenue, Eaton Square, Barton Drive, and Devlin Park. Precision is difficult, but I do well, matching the houses we lived in with the release of the Goodies song, Funky Gibbon, Mudd's version of Oh Boy, the Wolf Tone song about the IRA helicopter escape from Mountjoy Prison, and personal events mixed in with the historical. The day my mother remarried to an Irishman, the Dublin and Monaghan bombings, President Nixon's resignation, a Muhammad Ali fight. As though caught in a backdraft, I find myself back in Milwaukee from my 7th house, matching my 7 years of age. North 60th Street, Wauwatosa, Milwaukee, was where I had an idyllic 3 years of playing baseball in summer, American football in winter, going to Jefferson Elementary School, and looking up to my brother on a daily basis. But around me, were the invisible signs of family disintegration. And in the space of a few days, starting February 2nd, 1979, my mother separated from her husband. She, my sister and I moved back to Ireland, while my 16-year-old brother stayed in America. I would only see him once more in my life. This fracture was epitomised by the three children from the same parents living with different surnames. My brother took my father's, my sister my mother's maiden name, and I the name of a man I knew for only 4 years and to whom I am not related. Though it will mean nothing to the official reading the form, I draw a thick black line under that Wauwatosa house. Then houses 8 through 12, Shankill, Temple Oge, Black Rock, Monkstown, Shankill again, where I live for 5th and 6th class of primary school, which also happened to be at my 5th and 6th primary schools, and my sole secondary school, New Park Comprehensive. I narrow down dates by consulting the schedules of international and European club soccer matches, the release of songs by The Jam, The Pogues, Frankie Goes to Hollywood, Bruce Springsteen, the invasion of Lebanon by Israel, events from the Troubles, the first space shuttle launch, the assassination of Olaf Palme. Appropriately, when I move out of home, I have to start on a fresh new page, which I'll attach to the form. It's easy to date this house, June 9th, 1990, the day before Ireland played England in the 1990 World Cup. For 4 months, thanks to Dominic, a college friend who'd returned home for the summer, I live rent-free in Mespel Road on the Grand Canal and grow up more in those 4 months than I have done for the previous 4 years. This is where I'm living when I learn to like myself. So significant is this residence to me that I double the size of the address and the dates on the page. The form then takes on a pattern an official might be familiar with, houses and flats shared with friends, a room in Trinity College, a house on Erne Street off Pierce Street, Derrynane Gardens, Sandymount, Leinster Road, Rathmines, Greenville Terrace, South Circular Road, Nutley Avenue, Donnybrook, Percy Place. I draw another thick line before the final two addresses that cover the last 23 years. Library Road, Dunleary, the house my girlfriend Sinead and I bought, where we were married, where we had our two children, and the next house where we live still, just a kilometre and a half away. Then I am done. I review the form, satisfied at this personal document charting my life through 22 houses, and also happy that my own children, in their time, will have a far less complicated form to fill in. And then I give thought to the official unlucky enough to have to follow up on each of my 22 addresses, while a colleague of theirs might have received a form from a Tory Islander.
Look at me. Who am I supposed to be? Who am I supposed to be?
Last summer, you swam there once again, the water soothing and almost tepid as the smell of disturbed silt rose around you. In the distance, swans drifted, but the surface was calm, with pale rills of high cloud reflected in the water. There are few realizations that break as strongly as that feeling for the terrain around your first home. It is a totally truthful sense of attentiveness to growth, to rumpled, unexpected rises and dips in the ground, and the graceful sweep of ancient roots from beech trees or oaks. An affection almost equal to that felt towards another human. Everything you know about how to perceive the world was learnt here. Saturday mornings were for leaving the house and climbing up high, experiencing that sense of unburdened ownership of the world that sometimes comes with a shift in perspective. You see the high cathedral 2 miles away as the crow flies. Hear the clang of metal on metal as milk churns are unloaded at the creamery down the road. Catch sight of the house you live in, built in 1854, and see how well settled it is in itself, like an early Victorian lady sitting in spread skirts surveying the view to the southwest. For all of us, these first lessons in rhythm unfold in a seasonal dance that is like a kindly teacher. Not the one who inflicted misery on you in primary school, neither name-calling nor mocking. Instead, nature is the patient teacher in a Garden of Eden who shows what you are free to absorb and touch, an automatically Socratic presence that allows the inner self to deduce for itself. So everything you learnt about how time worked, how it made you feel, came from the discovery and observation of seasons, and within each season a month, and within those months the days. Later, you would read Philip Larkin's wise and melancholic question, "Where can we live but days?" And with that, would understand the freedom and the curtailments of time. But in childhood, rhythms were absorbed through physical freedom and an assumed right to wander where you want. In Monaghan, and at the age of 6, you trekked with Davy Simpson up and down his fields as the horse pulled the harrow, and together you ploughed up and down through the claggy clay. The sister and brother Simpsons, Emily and Davy, also offered the concept of a tea break and respite from labour during haymaking, sharing their tea in the novelty of tin mugs, unfolding thick sandwiches from paper bags, later teasing you by tossing you within the hay until, very briefly, you were enclosed within a stack. You recall laughter, their clear enjoyment of you, a child presence in their lives, and learn what it is to be approved of for no particular reason other than that you are fresh, new and willing to play. So it's to place that you still return, testing such deep attachments. Strip them back to their basics and you arrive at this word, love. You could whisper it repeatedly as if addressing a person. I love you. In another time it might be, I love thee. Or, thee I love. The thee is this place of fields high and low, known as intimately as a beloved body, undressed and lain beside, recognised as the only source of peace. Perhaps that's the nub of it. How many times in life do we feel deeply, ardently, free and at peace? You recall a time of no responsibilities whatsoever, and within that, time itself, turning over day by day, moving from explosions of cadmium yellow gorse as if imagined by Cézanne, who once said that colour is the place where our brain and the universe meet, to the white and pink toss of whitethorn blossom, and on to heavy haws in autumn, to collecting indigo sloes and fallen beech nuts. Then, the winters of heavy snows, when you imagined yourself as H.E. Bates's passionate Lydia skating with young Richardson all winter long. Except, of course, there was no ice skating in Monaghan. Nevertheless, the landscape seemed very novelistic and the fantasy of skating till dusk was not wasted. It was a song of innocence in your life, for you learned a little about temporality and beauty, and perhaps how to carry these forward into the days when experience would inevitably shoulder in beside such a foundation. And after the carrying forward, one day, sooner than you imagine, there will be the letting go. Again, as with a beloved body, its lineaments thinning, its strength waning with the confusions of passing time. Everything that has anchored you, providing you with your own special knowledge of what is unique and unimaginable by anybody else.
At first glance, the writers Angela Thirkell and Raymond Chandler don't seem to have much in common. In the first place, Chandler is a household name, even to people who haven't read his crime thrillers. Thirkell is virtually unknown nowadays. But both writers despised their own work. Chandler's alcoholism is reputed to have sprung, more than anything else, from his contempt for the waste of his intellect in writing what he considered low-class potboilers. Thurkel, too, despised her books. She claimed to be horrified at the thought that any of her well-educated, upper-middle-class friends might read her fiction. In other words, she was a crushing snob in literature as well as in life. And one doesn't have to probe too deeply into her books to find a distinct streak of anti-Semitism and a weary contempt for the vagaries of the lower classes in not recognising the immense superiority of those above them. Thurkel's characters, in the fastnesses of her invented county of Barsetshire, inspired by Trollope's mythical countryside, are empire builders and preservers, tranquilly certain of the superiority of all things British, or rather English. At best, they exude a remote sense of pity at times for those not lucky enough to have been born into their certainties. But the snobbery can't take away from the overwhelming charm and slightly acid humour of the novels Angela Thurkel wrote, almost 30 of them, between 1930 and her death in 1961. Nor was her career founded on educated middle-class dilettantism. It was sparked of necessity after years of sobering privation and unhappiness. Her first novel, High Rising, republished in 2012 by Virago, has a less than generous introduction by Alexander McCall Smith, who describes Thurkel as coming from a moderately distinguished family. In fact, Angela Margaret Mackail was born into artistic royalty in 1890. Her father, a classical scholar, was Oxford Professor of Poetry, and her mother was the daughter of the Pre-Raphaelite painter Edward Burne-Jones. That made her cousin to both Rudyard Kipling and Stanley Baldwin. Her godfather was J.M. Barrie, author of Peter Pan. Nor did her parents confine their daughter's spirit to the drawing room. She was educated at St. Paul's School in London, which to this day has one of the finest academic records in Britain, before being sent to Finnish in Paris. She was married for the first time at the age of 21 to a James Campbell McGuinness, and their first son was named Graham. That had been the name of McGuinness's former male lover. So the subsequent divorce and very public scandal seems hardly surprising, with McGuinness exposed as flagrantly promiscuous. It was, after all, within spitting years of Oscar Wilde's public disgrace. A second son of the scandalous marriage would grow up to be the celebrated novelist Colin McGuinness, clearly not reared by his mother to hide in shameful shadows. Unbowed by the scandal, Angela married George Thurkel, an engineer, at the end of the First World War, and they emigrated to Australia, where poverty indicated the unthinkable, a lower-class lifestyle. By 1929, she'd had enough and begged the fare home to England from her godfather, J.M. Barrie. He sent enough for a return ticket, but Angela booked one way, using the remainder to bring the son she'd had with Thurkel home with her. He was Lance Thurkel, destined to become controller of the BBC, another high achiever. Colin McGuinness later followed his mother and half-brother to London, leaving behind his stepfather and elder brother. By the standards of the time, Thurkel's was a rackety and scandalous life, and a million miles away from the novels she began writing, with rural gardens well cared for by devoted gardeners, where tennis parties flourished and indulgent termagants of housekeepers ensured that meals appeared effortlessly, no matter how many lovelorn guests called to cry their eyes out on the shoulders of understanding older men and women, or how many thoughtless sons brought down jolly good friends from Oxford for the long vacation. Angela Thurkel's first heroine was Laura Morland, a successful author of novels she herself considers trivial. Laura has untidy hair, is verging on middle age, and tolerates but never succumbs to the romantic blandishments of the various men who cross her path, among them some noticeably younger than herself. It's a theme that reappears in further books and would seem to indicate that, underestimate her creative talent though she might, Angela Thurkel by no means underestimated her own attractions while remaining determinedly single following the breakup of her second marriage. The books are mildly mocking of the lifestyle which Thirkell had lost through marriage but managed to regain through her own hard work and talent. And the snobbery is unabated as she traces her Barsetshire characters through the privations and dangers of the Second World War and the subsequent rise of those engaged in trade to join the ranks of the socially acceptable. But they're never pompous, and the humour is so wholeheartedly joyous that Angela Thirkell's slightly larger-than-life presentation of a world long gone is a perennial pleasure. And of course, the writing is superb.
Listen to the strain, it plays once more for us.
Oh, heck, it's Thursday. Film day, or rather no film day, at my school, near one of Beirut's lush parks. I get there by communal taxi, a black or sienna red Mercedes, orb-shaped headlights flashing, the dashboard garnished with multicoloured prayer beads, rosaries should the Lebanese driver be Maronite. Its horn bellowing along with all its cousins, forming a truly urban orchestra on the move. For my few piastres, I'm whisked along the boulevards to a three-story mock Venetian palace, manned by black-gowned Italo-American Salesian brothers. Solemn and pious, they are uniformly strict, as if all spontaneity had been drained away in their efforts to resist the temptations of the Levant. My left-handed hieroglyphics mark me out to the brothers as a challenging subversive. Brother Giorgio bars me from the Thursday afternoon film show, otherwise a weekly treat. Instead, I must remain in the classroom and attempt a perfect script, a punishment designed to cure my condition. He lectures me that the Romans, who once ruled this land, coined a name for my ilk, Sinister. I never get to watch the Thursday film. After school, another few piastres for the communal Mercedes, and I am home. In the flash it takes to change and to greet, if confronted, one of the bevy of earnest, beautifully clad and beautifully mannered Japanese wives who learn English from my mother, I am gone. The wives stare with politely masked disbelief as I retreat unceremoniously. Below the corniche, which lines the cliff top above the Mediterranean, I commandeer a flat-bottomed board and paddle along the indented coastline, where fishermen stand on salt-dashed rocks, their long bamboo rods hovering low over the water. Two giant teeth of sandstone, the Pigeon's Rock, rise from the sea. A huge cavity has forced a gap in one of these molars, through which I thread my way, more ignorant of peril than fearless. Two English brothers who live nearby are my closest friends. They are both snub-nosed and freckled, while I am their unspeckled pal, who keeps the peace. Their mother, a kind blonde belle from Surbiton in Surrey, is awkward in this city of swish boulevards, where elaborately gowned sheikhs rub shoulders with suave Westerners. My pals and I, the three musketeers, roam the scrubland behind the fringe of apartment blocks, seeking action. A stray dog joins our outfit as a mascot. One day, he succumbs to a frenzy and expires. After the concierge reports the incident, the city authorities act promptly and we are rounded up, putting an end to our forays. My father, a peacekeeper, is summoned back from his base in Gaza, almost 400 kilometres away. Our penalty for consorting with the mongrel is a precautionary treatment for rabies. This consists of a dozen injections into the lower abdomen, each one administered at weekly intervals using a viciously long needle. At the final session in the surgery, after the contents of the phial containing the precious serum have been exhausted, my parents solemnly prompt me to thank our Lebanese doctor for saving my life. So absorbed am I in this jingle-jangle world that I have only the merest grasp of the danger from which I have been delivered. A white Russian couple, whose families had escaped from the Bolsheviks after the revolution, are my mother's unofficial minders while my father is away. They live with an enormous, overfed white rabbit, which has the freedom of their apartment. The couple bicker constantly in Russian, and the Baroness bursts into tears at the slightest provocation. The Baron, who works for an aid organization for Russian emigres, owns a black, fin-tailed Buick driven by his Lebanese bodyguard, who is virtually a member of the family. At weekends, the bodyguard takes us all to the biblical-age towns of Tyre and Sidon, on snorkeling expeditions to underwater Roman ruins off the coast, or high up into the cedar forests in the north. He carries a pistol tucked into his waistline. I am fascinated by the weapon. None of the other adults need a protector. Overheard mutterings suggest that the Baron's organization is a mask for something very different. The Baron and my father are close friends and share an Arabian stallion named Habib el Arab. Occasionally, when he is at home, the three of us set off in the early morning to the stables in the red-earthed, pine-fringed plain on the edge of the city, where they take turns to ride the stallion, while I follow on a placid nag. The balcony of our apartment is L-shaped, allowing me to observe the goings-on in the neighbourhood. Below us lives a Lebanese farmer and his family, his yard shaded by vines. By day, he tills the red earth, his plough pulled by two oxen, right up to our boundary wall. After dark, I look up to the rooftop apartment on the adjoining block, whose Latin American occupants party ceaselessly. Girlish giggles and the clinking of glasses give way, as the night progresses, to the loud beat of salsa music, strung through with the shrieks of the girls. Early one morning, I am awakened by the sound of women keening. I look down to see black-clad mourners arriving at the farm and realize that our neighbor, the farmer, a husband and father, has died. The funeral rites last for days and days. Were the revelers ever to peer down, or the mourners to raise their eyes, they would see, on the balcony, the figure of a boy grappling with experience.
On this morning's programme, we heard Summer in Andorra by Michael O'Loughlin, 22 Houses by Tim Carey, Land Love by Mary O'Donnell, the moderately distinguished Angela Thirkell by Emer O'Kelly, and In the Levant by Justin McCarthy. The music was Lily Marlene, sung by Marlena Dietrich, Look at Me by John Lennon, The Monaghan Jig, played by Cormac de Barra on harp, with Fionnán de Barra on guitar, and Mario Ngoma on percussion. And Play, Orchestra Play, by Noel Coward and Gertrude Lawrence. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Carolyn Dempsey. The producer is Sarah Binchy. You can listen back to this morning's programme on the RTE radio player, and further details are available on rte.ie/radio1/Sunday Miscellany.